PBS Radio.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
Welcome back, everybody, to the People Who Speak radio show. I'm your host for tonight, Steve Johnson. The People Who Speak show normally airs every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific and 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS radio network. You can participate during the show with call-in questions for our guests toll-free in the USA and Canada on 1-888-429-5471. Or you can join us live in the government and politics section of Pound Talk, the largest free chat program in the world, where we have a virtual radio room, The People Who Speak show, where that anyone may join to participate in the show. This is a fantastic show tonight. I'm more excited than a Wahhabi provocateur getting his first Mossad paycheck. We're talking to a very special guest right here, a very outspoken and well-read researcher and an author of three books about the modern false flags and a prolific columnist and writer. He's a devout convert to the Muslim religion and currently works as a nonprofit organizer, a public speaker, author, and talk show host on No Lies Radio. We are talking tonight to the eminent Dr. Kevin Barrett about the current surge of false flags attacks happening all around the world. Welcome to the People Speak radio show, Dr. Barrett, sir.
Hey, thank you, Steve. You don't have to call me your eminence. Kevin is fine.
Assalamu alaikum, Hashabab.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Alhamdulillah. We'll be taking audience questions after the first half hour, sir. But my first question to you tonight is, how did you get started into researching and uncovering government deceptions?
Well, it's kind of a long story, I guess. I first awakened to how bad it is when I was, I think, 14 or 15 in high school. I went to see Mark Lane speak in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and show the Zapruder film. And as you may know, the Zapruder film shows President Kennedy's head getting blown backwards and his brain splattering all out backwards. Obviously, he's shot by a high-powered rifle from the front. The official story was that he was shot by a very low-powered and very inaccurate Mannlicher Carcano rifle from an impossible range through tree branches from the back. So I saw that, and then I saw Mark Lane show the Life magazine depiction of the relevant frames of the Zapruder film. And Life magazine had reversed the frames to make it look like the head snap was going forward and Kennedy was shot from behind, as the official story said. So I looked at that and I called up some film labs and said, could this be a mistake? And they all said, are you kidding? So from that point on, I knew we had a really serious problem at the highest level of government. And so, you know, knowing that at age 14 or 15, it's, I guess, not that surprising that I would wake up to 9/11 2 years after it happened. I guess what's really mysterious is why it would take me 2 years.
Wow. You did first hit the 9/11 truth spotlight on or around 2006 with some very brave appearances on mainstream media, which caused a huge backlash against you as a professor. Can you share with the audience a bit more about that?
Yeah, well, I started doing serious 9/11 truth activism in early 2004 and then really ramped it up in fall 2004. Just as I was finishing my PhD, I was doing teach-ins at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And I was also teaching Islam classes and things like that then. So I organized these various events, including David Ray Griffin's breakthrough event at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 2005. That was broadcast live and then repeatedly rebroadcast on C-SPAN. It was the first time that 9/11 truth had really made it big time. And so I was a victim of my success. I kind of had to keep working at 9/11 truth after that. And then in June of 2006, everything really hit the fan. We had a very, very successful event, which I co-organized with 911truth.org, and that was in Chicago early June. Then Alex Jones had his event in L.A. Both events drew 1,500-plus people each, and ours was first, and we had New York Times and all kinds of big press there covering us. So I think that 9/11 Truth was starting to break out at that point. There were nearly 100 scholars for 9/11 Truth, that is, university professors, all saying the official story was a lie. And so that's when the bad guys had to push back. So what must have happened is that Republican Party propagandist bigwigs, or whoever's in charge with trying to cover up the tracks of the real 9/11 perps, sent the Republicans in the state legislature after me. First, they ambushed me on a radio talk show out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and tried to get me to say something crazy. And I did. I just, you know, said what I thought about 9/11. The next morning, Representative Steve Nass, a Republican neocon tool in the state legislature, put out a press release saying I should be fired from the university. So I spent the next 6 months teaching my class under fire, being dragged all over the headlines and Fox News and CNN and stuff. I was that 9/11 truth professor. And there's still a lot of people who remember me that way. I've seen you somewhere before. Oh, you're that 9/11 truth professor, whatever. You're that conspiracy professor. So since then, I've been unable to make a living in the American Academy. You know, the University of Wisconsin lost $500,000 in one day when I was on Hannity and Combs. And nobody's going to hire me and get blasted by, both by the government and, more importantly, by the private donors who withdraw their money from the university. So I'm completely unemployable in the United States. So I've gone on to another career track, which is writing books, doing journalism and broadcasting, trying to wake people up on all of these issues, not just 9/11, but the other issues that are too hot for the mainstream.
And how has that gone with your books? Are you getting good sales and people are quite responsive to it?
Well, you know, moderately good, not as good as Noam Chomsky thinks. You know, Chomsky and I had a big fight because, you know, he just said so many idiotic things. We had an email exchange and he said crazy things like, well, even if you guys prove that they blew up the Trade Center, that'll just prove that Bin Laden did it. This is Chomsky, the genius who thinks that. And then he, you know, what really bothered me was he said, and you guys, you 9/11 truthers are getting the best possible placement in all the big chain bookstores. You know, you're up in the first row in Barnes and Noble. You know, they're really pushing you because they want people to believe your stupid conspiracy theories. And, you know, the truth is the exact opposite. You know, we are just being completely blacklisted, boycotted. You can't imagine how impossible it is to try to sell any 9/11 truth books in any kind of mainstream outlet, you know, mainstream media. They will do everything to stop you. Whereas Chomsky's book on 9/11 was a bestseller right after 9/11 because it was designed to brainwash the left-leaning liberals who don't like George Bush into not thinking about the evidence that it was an inside job. So Chomsky is completely full of it. The man is a liar. He's a scumbag, and Barry Zwicker could very well be right that he's actually carrying water for the killers of Kennedy and the people who murdered 3,000 people at the Trade Center in order to murder millions of others.
That certainly does sound like a gatekeeper to me, somebody who's distracting people and not pointing out the real evidence. Is that not true?
Yeah. I mean, you know, you can always say somebody like Chomsky has done some good work exposing, you know, complicity of the empire in human rights abuses in Indonesia and things like that. And I will grant him that he has done that kind of work quite well. But what's his real role? You know, how does he expose that information? Is it designed to rile up the American people and make them rise up and put an end to these abuses? No, it's designed to put them to sleep. His passive-aggressive manner, his whiny style is designed to prevent people from actually rising up in revolt. And that's why when something like JFK or 9/11 happens, where if the people got the truth about these things, they would be, you know, I talk to my friends here in Lone Rock, Wisconsin sometimes, and my acquaintances. There's a local tavern where I watch the Packer game. You know, there's a trailer park. These are pretty common, ordinary folks here. And what I hear over and over and over is, you know, if what you say about 9/11 were true and I were convinced it were true, I would have to take a gun, put it in my pickup truck and drive to D.C. right now. So Chomsky's role is to make sure that such things never happen, that nobody ever gets really angry enough to actually change anything.
I was watching earlier one of your first media appearances on the Bill O'Reilly show. Very, very interesting. This guy, even though he calls you a conspiracy whack job, I do believe from that appearance on TV, you got an amazing amount of support as well. Is that not true? You got a lot of people writing in that were supporting you?
Yeah, there were tons of people writing into the university. Actually, I think it was split close to 50-50. And that's pretty amazing because there wasn't really any organized 9/11 truth campaign to get people to write. And there was a huge organized campaign by Lynn Cheney's group, ACTA, that conned relatively unsophisticated Fox viewers into emailing me at the university and in many cases giving me death threats and calling me names. And those same people also emailed the administration. And yet, despite the fact that they had an AstroTurf well-funded elected, you know, Lynn Cheney, led by the wife of the Vice President of the United States. Very, very organized effort to get people to email the university against me. It ended up being pretty balanced, the pro and the con. And what was really interesting was that the pro emails were all very, very well written, articulate, logical, citing evidence. And the anti-emails, like, you know, couldn't spell three-letter words correctly. Or, you know, three grammatical errors per sentence and misspelled three-letter words. So when I get death threats with that kind of writing, you know, I figure, well, these guys probably, if they can't write, they probably can't lock and load either.
Yeah, they probably can't think for themselves or do basic function.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, that's what 9/11 was designed to do, is to brainwash the idiots, you know, to get all the idiots drooling and waving the flag. Let's go off and kill some Muslims. You know, that, and it worked fine. But, you know, an army of brainwashed morons is really not that difficult of an adversary to defeat. A much smaller army of intelligent people of goodwill should be able to defeat it.
Do you believe that since those days, since around 2006, which is now 10 years ago, unbelievably, do you believe that the tide has turned, that a lot more people now are asking the right questions and looking at the right evidence?
Well, the word has certainly spread. We haven't been able to get really good big protest actions. And, you know, it's interesting that when that happens, when there is a big protest action, it really does scare the powers that be. And a good example of that is that the Million Family March organized by the Nation of Islam and Louis Farrakhan last year, maybe it was a year and a half ago or whatever, that really scared them because, you know, it was a pro 9/11 truth event. I mean, it covered a bunch of issues, Black Lives Matter, stuff like that. But 9/11 truth was right up there with them. And having a million people, or what, maybe half a million, that's a lot of people in Washington, D.C. at a pro 9/11 truth event. And so, you know, the powers that be are still freaking out about that. I just wrote an article about Prince's death, suggesting that the fact that Prince gave $50,000 for that event, that the biggest 9/11 truth event ever in history, may be related to his bizarre demise. With no, you know, there's no reason for this 57-year-old guy to just drop dead from catching the flu last week. I mean, it's all very strange. And this arch neocon Zionist named Schlussel has published a piece, I think, representing the views of the hardcore Zionist 9/11 perps, just really ripping on Prince, dancing on his grave, spitting on his grave. And what really riles her and the Zionists up is that Prince gave that $50,000 for this 9/11 truth event in D.C. So, you know, make of that what you will.
Okay, can you confirm that, that Prince actually did give $50,000 for a 9/11 truth march? That's true? That is absolutely true?
Yeah. It was put out by in a press release by the Nation of Islam, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, in his press release, said very, very kind things about Prince and mentioned that Prince had given $50,000 for that event. Now, the event was billed as the Million Families March, I think. It was a follow-up on the anniversary of the original Million Man March back in the 90s. And it, one of the issues there was 9/11 truth. Many leading 9/11 truth people, including myself, you know, were brought to D.C. To be part of that event. And the Honorable Minister Farrakhan has been very, very outspoken in calling for 9/11 truth and in underlining the lead role played by Israel and its American assets in orchestrating 9/11. So, yeah, Prince gave $50,000 for that event. It's not just a 9/11 truth event. It's an all-out 9/11 truth event. It's a, you know, Zionist did 9/11 truth event. And so you can see why these neocon Zionists are really freaking out about this, spitting on Prince's grave, and they're terrified that Prince's heirs will continue to perhaps spend money on exposing these crimes.
I have seen the videos where Prince talks about chemtrails and talks about how when the air is sprayed, people get angry and how it affects people's moods and changes people's ideas. Do you think it's possible he was a closet 9/11 truther and never actually said anything about it?
I think he must have been. He's well known to have been a fan of David Icke. And David Icke, you know, whatever you may think about his reptilians and stuff like that, has been right about a whole lot of things. And one of them was 9/11. You know, David Icke's book on 9/11 was it Alice at the Trade Center? That came out 1 year after 9/11 in September 2002. It was one of the very earliest books on 9/11, and it got almost everything right. If you go back and read that today, you'll be shocked at how much of the information that you might think came out much later was actually in that book. A lot of this information was actually available in 2001. It's just that most of us took our time in discovering it. So, yeah, if he was a fan of David Icke, he obviously had some questions about 9/11.
I do believe there's a lot more of celebrities out there that are interested in and do know the truth about 9/11, but they're just too scared to say anything for fear that they're going to lose their jobs and lose their credibility. Do you think that's true?
Oh, sure, of course. Or maybe even lose their lives. Who knows? Because the thing is, the way it works, and I try to explain this to people in Iran. You know, I've been to Iran 3 times in the last couple of years. I've lectured at many of their major universities, including their leading technical school, where graduates in subjects like physics are likely to be assassinated by the Israeli Mossad. Many of them have been. So I've lectured to these audiences in Iran, and they're often, you know, very smart people. And I talk about 9/11, and they say, how can you say this stuff in public? I mean, if what you're saying is true, how could they let you continue to speak? And I explained to them that the way it works in the United States, unlike many other countries, is that you have to be an actionable threat before they take action against you based on how big of a threat you pose to them. So somebody like me who has a relatively modest audience and a really modest bank account, I mean, modest isn't even the word. My net worth is way into the negatives. So how much of a threat do I really pose? They look at me and they probably shake their heads and say, well, you know, this guy thinks his truth jihad is really going to expose 9/11. Yeah, good luck with that. Whereas somebody like Jimmy Walter, for example, is a multimillionaire who woke up to 9/11 early on and spent millions of dollars spreading around 9/11 truth DVDs, organizing conferences, and so on. He took out full-page ads in the Washington Post, the New York Times, and that made him an actionable threat. Now, they didn't kill him. They didn't. What they did was they vandalized his house, gave him death threats to the point that he realized he couldn't stay in America and he couldn't keep doing 9/11 truth work. So he fled the country. He's been living in Vienna, Austria ever since. And they took him out of the game. He's, you know, he stopped spending his money for 9/11 truth. So people who have these kinds of resources that make them what would be called in the intelligence world an actionable threat are the people who get stopped one way or another. And somebody like Prince, who had $50 million to $100 million and was totally on board with all of these pro-truth positions and maybe throwing some money at some of them, such as that conference in D.C., I mean, this guy would have been certainly on the agenda to be considered about, you know, what are we going to do to contain this guy? And that's how the bad guys think. And, you know, it wouldn't really surprise me that much if maybe they had some idea that Prince was going to be doing stuff in the future that would be dangerous for them. And so they might have taken him out preemptively. I mean, that's I don't know for sure, but it's certainly not all that improbable.
You know, you mentioned Jimmy Walter. A lot of respect out to that guy. He may have lost his fortune spending and promoting 9/11 truth, but he certainly hasn't stopped talking about it.
Yeah, he hasn't. I mean, he's not pushing it hardcore, and he's not spending money on it. That's the important thing. But no, he's not going to shut up and toe the party line. He's still speaking his mind in many ways. I've actually had some quarrels with him because he's not a big fan of Islam. You know, he's got his own kind of utopian worldview, and in many respects it just doesn't line up at all with any kind of traditionalist spiritual or religious worldview, least of all Islam. So, you know, he's put out some anti-Islam stuff that has annoyed me, and I've, you know, we've had a little quarrel here and there about that, but I still have immense respect for him, and I certainly pray that Allah will forgive any of his trespasses in favor of all of the good that he's done.
Yes, sir. I saw an article just recently that you wrote pointing out the recent Brussels bombing that occurred in Belgium, occurred on the 22nd of March. Can you elucidate further why that particular date is significant to certain secret societies?
Well, the secret societies apparently are into numerology, and they look at dates, as Captain Eric May, the former Army intelligence officer, explained to me. Back when I didn't believe him in those days, I thought he was, you know, really smoking something. But, you know, he explained that they line up the numbers and the dates. They just get rid of the zeros. and then these numbers form codes, and there are certain kinds of numbers that mean stuff to them. For example, 911, the date of the World Trade Center and Pentagon attack, that 911 accomplishes a lot of things. I mean, at one level, of course, it's the emergency call number. So it means a state of emergency. It means call the government to save you if there's an emergency. That's a pretty good number code for that date. But it's also, it represents this satanic moving from 9 to 11 and skipping 10, which is the number of transcendence in the decimal system. So it's a satanic, like going one step beyond God. There's that. And then for various reasons, 11 is a huge Illuminati number, supposedly, maybe because it represents those two ones, or the two towers of Hakim and Boaz, or whatever, the Freemasonic two towers. Isn't that interesting? The top symbol of Freemasonry is the Twin Towers, and that's what they hit on 9/11. And the other one is the pentagram, and that's the other thing they hit on 9/11. So anyway, Brussels, getting back to Brussels, 322. 322 is the number code that means skull and bones. America's leading satanic CIA feeding secret society, where they have a bizarre satanic initiation ritual at Yale University every year. The neophytes get naked and masturbate in a coffin in front of all of their frat brothers and their fathers, recounting their entire sexual histories. You can believe that after they've done that, they are pretty shameless, and so they're ready to go to work for the CIA, smuggling drugs, killing people, and amassing fortunes, helping their skull and bones brothers amass their fortunes by doing whatever it takes. They've become basically psychopaths who can work with other psychopaths like wolves working against the rest of us who are the sheep. So anyway, 322, that's skull and bones. And it's also the culminating day on this three-day satanic holiday that represents the invocation of Isis, not the terror group, but the pagan goddess. So there are all of these levels where they're sending these little signals. It's quite interesting. And, you know, I used to think people who talked like this were crazy conspiracy nuts, but now I guess I've become one of them because I've seen too much evidence. It looks like this all really is true.
Can I point out, you're not a conspiracy theorist as such. You're a conspiracy factist. You get into the facts that are provable in these conspiracies. Is that correct?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's, of course, a difference between talking about the numerology, which is inherently a little bit speculative, and talking about other kinds of facts, like, you know, say a document that says that certain Saudi government people funded 9/11, things like that. But ultimately, what we're always doing, just like any police officer investigating any crime, is we're picking up all of these different breadcrumbs of facts and then trying to understand what they mean. And in many cases, we're basically asking the question of, well, what are the odds? You know, what are the odds, for example, that three buildings would just disappear through the path of most resistance at free fall acceleration, allegedly due to office fires, when there's never been even a complete collapse of any kind of any tall building in history due to anything other than controlled demolition? What are the odds that suddenly this would happen, this apparently impossible thing that's never happened before would suddenly happen not once, not twice, but three times in one day? I mean, to me, those are facts that call out, you know, what are the odds? Likewise, with this numerology thing, what are the odds that it would be exactly 911 days between 9/11 and the Madrid bombing? You know, what are the odds that these terrorists, ISIS terrorists, would pick a satanic holiday whose date code is the same as it means skull and bones for an Islamic terror event? You know, what are the odds? So you go through all of these factoids and you ask, well, what are the odds that this fact could be explained innocently? What are the odds that the explanation is not so innocent? It's just what a police officer would do investigating any crime. And it's really not that hard to figure out these high crimes like the JFK assassination and 9/11. You just have to put together all of these various data points and ask what the odds are. And it all pretty much explains itself.
So in your opinion, the attack in Brussels on 322 was nothing more than just one more false flag?
It looks like it. I think we're suffering through a Gladio B false flag crime wave. It's been pretty well established that most of the big emblematic left-wing terror attacks during the Cold War were part of Operation Gladio and commanded through NATO, which is the U.S. military occupation of Europe, and commanded by the American military high command. And even the European Parliament has endorsed that conclusion. Today, it seems that Gladio has morphed, and instead of blaming these things on leftists, they're now blaming them on Muslims. So just as throughout the Cold War, most of those big events were actually inside jobs, false flags. The same is true today. And if you get, you know, you dig beneath the surface of any of these big emblematic so-called Islamic terror attacks, and you keep finding the same problems, you know, the same issues with the official story over and over and over. There are a lot of things that don't line up, and there are, in many cases, even smoking guns. So I think we can be confident, even, you know, anytime you hear the corporate media tell you that there's been a big Islamic terror attack in the U.S. or in Europe, you can assume that it's a false flag until proven otherwise.
You know, very interestingly, you mentioned Captain Eric May earlier. He was one of the first people I interviewed back online, I think about 2008. He was actually one of the only surviving members of the Ghost Platoon. Do you know much about that?
Right. Yeah, the Ghost Platoon was the group that Eric organized. He left the Army Intelligence. He got a job in the mainstream media. He was an editorialist at the big mainstream paper in Houston. And he's well-connected. Chase Untermyer, the former U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia, is a friend, close friend of his. And he woke up to 9/11, and I helped push him over the line and go totally public and just come right out and say, yeah, right, this is, of course, an inside job. And so he organized this Ghost Platoon, which was a bunch of ex-military people who were not happy about 9/11 and other manifestations of this kind of Zionist criminal cabal taking over the country. So they did a lot of good stuff, and Eric was especially expert at this numerology stuff. And some of it, you know, when I look at the numerology, for me, I have to sort of take each of these data points and ask, well, what are the odds? And in some cases, no, this isn't enough of a freaky coincidence to really necessarily mean that much. But then in another case, I would say, well, yeah, this is a very, very difficult thing to explain innocently. It looks like a dangerous factoid, you know, something that could it could point fingers at you know, who's behind it. So anyway, he did great work for a long time. Unfortunately, you know, he got ill and was unable to continue. But yeah, Ghost Troop sort of laid the basis for the efforts that have followed for military people to get the word out about 9/11 and related issues.
You mentioned earlier that you spend a lot of time talking in Iran. How are you greeted in Iran? Are you warmly welcomed generally?
Oh, yeah. The Iranian people are very hospitable, very, very sweet people. And the ones who don't like the American government, which is, of course, the people I hang out with, are very much, you know, they go out of their way to let you know that it's not American people they don't like. In fact, they see that the American people are being swindled by the same people that they don't like in the government and in the ruling circles. Mm-hmm. I was in the middle of a demonstration of, I think it was like 5 million people marching on the anniversary of the Islamic Revolution of 1979. And there were signs all around with death to Israel, death to America. Yeah, I wanted one of those death to America signs to take back as a souvenir, but they convinced me that maybe TSA or whoever, you know, would not like that at the airport. But, you know, these people would talk to me and say, well, you know, we're not so sure about this slogan, you know, death to America. It's getting kind of old, and it's not like the country we don't like. It's your leaders we don't like. And I said, yeah, I get it. But yeah, Iran's a fun place. I look forward to going back again.
And the people really like your message out there. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, Iran is a very rare country in having a significant element of the people with some power who are really dedicated to trying to tell these hard truths. You know, you would think that Saudi Arabia, which was set up to get blamed for 9/11, you know, they decided to use 15 of the 19 alleged hijackers. They picked Saudis precisely in order to get leverage over Saudi Arabia. You know, you would think that the Saudi government would be very happy to promote 9/11 truth tellers. But of course, they're not, because they play the game of the empire. They're under the thumb of the Rothschild Zionists, who are the banksters behind the big empire, and they'll do what they're told. Iran has a significant element of people who are really dedicated to trying to do the right thing. And I think the supreme leader is in that camp. And these people, they call themselves the principalists. They believe in standing on principle and doing the right thing, even if it's not pragmatic. And, of course, they're being pushed back at by the pragmatists, otherwise known as the reformists. So that's the political struggle over there. It's not Democrats versus Republicans. It's principalists versus reformists. And I hang out with the principalists. They're the ones who are called the evil radical Muslims in the American press. What they really are is truthers. They're people who believe in truth and justice and believe it's worth sacrificing pragmatism to get truth and justice. And I agree with that. I mean, if I were a pragmatist, I'd probably have tenure at some university and I'd just forget about 9/11 and be doing, you know, research on medieval Sufism or something like that. And I'd have an easy life. But I wouldn't feel good about myself. You know, some of us have that principled need to stand on principles. So I really appreciate the fact that the power structure in Iran actually has these powerful people who feel that way. I mean, what other country is like that? Name one. I can't think of any that has anything remotely comparable to that.
Well, do stick with us. This is the People Speak Radio Show. I'm your host, Steve Johnson, talking with special guest Kevin Barrett live on Internet Radio. And we'll be right back with our guest and audience questions after this short message break.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
With over 150 million registered users, PalTalk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 PalTalk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining PalTalk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Today's school libraries are filled with endless opportunities. With access to print and digital materials, the latest technologies, and the guidance of a school librarian, our children are empowered with the tools they need to succeed in school and beyond. I'm Julianne Moore. Join me in celebrating all of the ways that school libraries and librarians are transforming learning for our students. For more information on how you can become involved, visit the American Association of School Librarians at aasl.org.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak, every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern, on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to the People Who Speak Radio Show, coming to you live across America and across the world in real time on the BBS Radio Network. I'm your host for tonight, Steve Johnson, and we're back with our very special guest, Dr. Kevin Barrett. I encourage all the listeners to visit his website at www.truthjihad.com. Welcome back there, Dr. Barrett, sir.
Hey, welcome back. It's good to be with you.
Absolutely. We have a question here from the audience. Frank in St. Louis would like to know, what was the actual motive for 9/11, and who do you think really benefited?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it, Frank? You know, I kind of, in the early days of 9/11 Truth, I was always very, very sensitive about the way I would discuss this because you get so much pushback. But I'll just come right out now, as I have been for the past several years, and say I think the number one motive was to trick the West, and especially the United States, which has the world's biggest military, into destroying Israel's enemies and continuing to do so for a long period, perhaps up to, you know, decades or even a century. I think that when Wesley Clark told us after 9/11 that he'd been approached by these neocons, these Zionist dual citizen Israel loyalist neocons, right after 9/11, saying the plan is to take out seven countries in 5 years, that really explains what it was really all about. And there's a paper trail there. We know that starting way back in the 70s, Oded Yanon in Israel said, if Israel's going to survive and thrive and keep expanding and be prosperous and powerful, it needs to break up the countries on its borders, weaken them and balkanize them and smash them into little pieces along ethnic and sectarian lines. Then in 1995, there was the Clean Break document, which was the American neocons writing a document for Netanyahu about how they were going to have to regime change these countries like Iraq and Syria and Libya, Sudan, et cetera, et cetera. Exactly the countries that were on the list that General Clark saw after 9/11. So then 9/11 happens, and, you know, 15 of the hijackers or alleged hijackers are Saudis. So do we attack Saudi Arabia? No. On September 12th, Bush is out on the White House balcony smoking cigars with Prince Bandar, the guy that we now hear from the 28 pages was involved in setting up these alleged hijackers. So what's really going on here? Well, I think it was basically these Zionist assets of the state of Israel in the United States, Wolfowitz, Pearl, Dov Zakheim, the controller at the Pentagon, who apparently stole.
Are you there, sir? I think we might have lost him. Dr. Barrett?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes. We lost you at Dov Zakheim, who stole $2.3 trillion. Is that right?
Yeah. So basically here, you know, I think that the one group that really had a motive to do something as extreme and take as big a gamble as 9/11 was the hardline Zionist extremists, the Likud party people, Netanyahu's people, the
Right. We have a question here from Phil in Kentucky. Why do you think that some 9/11 activists get the access to mainstream media and others don't?
Well, that's a good question. I think, although there hasn't been that much access to mainstream media. I mean, I was, you know, they did a blitzkrieg against me in 2006 for several months. And then, boom, they shut down. And, you know, once I got my book published, they wouldn't come near me. And they haven't come near me, really. They've tried very hard to not come near me now for many, many years. I don't know. You know, it's hard to tell. I mean, you can get mainstream coverage at your local newspaper sometimes. Those people are not controlled. But the big groups are controlled. And maybe, can he tell us which 9/11 truth people are getting mainstream coverage?
Oh, no, that was just a general question to say that, you know, some are and some aren't. Why do you think that is? Do you think that
I don't see anybody getting coverage except maybe a little bit of this 28 pages issue now, but they're not covering the 9/11 truth activists.
Okay, well, one example is Alex Jones on Piers Morgan. Well, why is he
okay, Alex, yeah. You're right. Alex gets all kinds of mainstream coverage, and the speculation is that Alex is... His style is so, you know, wired and, you know, sometimes a little paranoid or sort of fearful that he, like Chomsky, he's not really inspiring people with the kind of, you know, strong courage to go out and change things. That's one aspect. And the other is that he really is not pushing on the Zionists. If he starts talking about the Zionists, the Israelis doing 9/11, and he did have Steve Pieznak saying that recently, and, you know, God bless him for that. But if he really pushes that, then they'll find a way to shut him down. So I think that's, again, really the issue. Our country has been taken over by partisans of the state of Israel.
Well, I guess Alex doesn't want to push the Zionist did 9/11 because I'm Alex Jones. I got a DVD for $29.95. Buy my water filter, but don't listen to the Zionists.
Yeah, pretty much.
Wow. We have a question here from Winston Smith in Hawaii. Are the Zionists actually a different species altogether?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe a few of them are, but no, I doubt that very much. I think that, yeah, well, the definition of Zionist is really just somebody who supports a Jewish state in Palestine. And some of those people who support a Jewish state in Palestine, which is most Americans, and certainly, you know, most American Jews, they're not any different from us. They've just gotten bad information. They imagine that it somehow makes sense to respond to the Nazi Holocaust by setting up this state in Palestine that everybody in the neighborhood hates. I mean, to me, it's completely insane going all the way around the world to start an ethnic supremacist state and in the Holy Land, no less, land that's holy to all of the world's billions of Christians and Muslims. But no, these like a handful of million Jews should turn it into Jews-only Holy Land and ethnically cleanse everybody else. It's completely nuts. But we've all been brainwashed because the people who support this project own our media, they own our government, they own the biggest financial institutions. So I guess, you know, it's normal that normal people, decent people, are Zionists. Some of my friends are Zionists. Some of my friends are right-wing Zionists. Barry Chamish, who's actually in my We Are Not Charlie Hebdo book, is a hardcore right-wing Zionist. So most of them are just normal people who've been misled. And, you know, maybe there are a few reptilians up at the top, but I haven't really proven that.
Well, Barry Chamish is a different example because he's actually a very good researcher compared some of the Zionists that I've seen and heard talk about us goyim. So I think there's a big difference in Zionists even themselves.
Absolutely. And you know, just like any religion, Judaism has a lot of different interpretations. And there are very, very ethnocentric, chauvinistic, you know, Jewish superiority type Jews. And then there are also people who interpret Judaism as a call to serve God, to humble themselves, to do good in the world. And a lot of those people are like Naturae Carta, you know, they're opposed to Zionism. So there's a wide variety of people out there, including in the Jewish faith.
Oh, there's also the Shminitism, the conscientious objectors from the IDF, who I give a lot of props out to, a lot of support, because they support Palestine. They will not serve in the IDF's name. And these are even the daughter of the head of the Mossad, Omer Goldman. She's a Shminitism. She believes that we should just leave the Palestinians quite the hell alone.
Yeah, there are all more and more of these high-level young people from Zionist backgrounds who are rebelling against their elders and saying, you know, you guys are crazy. We're hearing this. And some of the elders are now coming along. We have the case of Max Blumenthal, whose father, Sidney Blumenthal, is a very high-placed, you know, mover and shaker, politically connected Zionist Jew, although he's maybe not so Zionist now because he's been talking to his son. It's like Jesse Ventura talked to Tyler and woke up to 9/11, and you know, hopefully, you know, Oliver Stone is talking with Sean Stone and learning a few things about 9/11 as well. But yeah, there are a lot of these young Jewish people who are turning against the Zionist brainwashing that their elders have been trying to inflict on them.
We have a question here from Buzzy Krongard in Langley, Virginia. I don't know if it's a real one, but hey, we can take his question. Do Iranians generally think that 9/11 was a West/Israeli operation, or do they believe that radical Islamists did it alone?
No, I think they're pretty hip to it being an inside job and basically a Zionist job. That's certainly what they're, you know, they're willing to allow us to say that on Press TV. And if you look at who do they invite on Press TV, there's me, you know, there are people like Mark Glenn, Jim Fetzer, the Veterans Today crew, Gordon Duff. I mean, all of these people are not only 9/11 truthers.
Don't forget Max Egan.
Oh, yeah, don't forget Max. They have a lot of 9/11 truthers, and especially ones who are willing to talk about the Zionist connection. So, yeah, I think the Iranian government is fully aware, fully informed about 9/11, and most of the Iranian people, I think, have a pretty good idea, too, as do people most of the Muslim world. I mean, you know, the polls show about 80% of the world's Muslims know or strongly suspect it was an inside job, and none of the polls talk about Zionist connections, but if they did, I'm sure that that would be a majority.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Forever Mike in England wanted to know what percentage of the Muslim community is aware that 9/11 was an inside job. And you say it was about 80%?
Yeah. I mean, you could, depending on how you interpret the polls, you could push it down to 70% or whatever. But you still get a broad majority. There was, for instance, a poll by worldpublicopinion.org back in 2008. And it found a wide range of differences in the different Muslim countries. But if you add up the total, you know, based on the country's populations and stuff, you get well, like 75% plus. And remember, these are taken by Western polling outfits that are not really interested in hearing about 9/11 truth. So I think they grossly understate the real number. And the same is true here in the U.S., where the polls have showed that about 2/3 of Muslims think 9/11 was an inside job. I think the real number is probably a little higher, but there's a lot of uncertainty. You know, very few people have really done the research. It takes so much time, and it turns you into a social pariah if you find what you're afraid you're
trying, you got that right.
Find. So a lot of folks are kind of in the middle. You know, they kind of know it was, or kind of suspect, but they're not really going to put their lives on the line for it.
We have a question from Marcy in St. Louis. Why don't more world leaders like Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and Vladimir Putin call out America for being complicit in 9/11? Why do you think that is?
Well, Ahmadinejad did. he repeatedly called out 9/11 as an inside job.
Like him? Why don't more leaders like him call out America for being complicit?
Right, right. Well, Putin didn't. I just wanted to start by saying Ahmadinejad did repeatedly, but Putin, I don't believe, has called out anybody on 9/11. So why doesn't he? A lot of us suspect that he's hanging on to some satellite photos that will show that what really happened on 9/11 was not what we were told, where the planes went and so on. And it's probably a good ace in the hole for him to hang on to. I think for the other world leaders, they know they're going to get lots of pushback. I mean, the way most people operate is they do what they think is in their perceived self-interest, what's going to make their lives comfortable, what's going to bring them more wealth, more power, what have you. World leaders are no different. And any world leader who speaks out about 9/11 is putting themselves in the crosshairs of a very powerful weapon. So right. I'm pretty sure, you know, that explains it.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. How much information is there showing the Paris attacks, like Charlie Hebdo, with staged psychological operations?
Well, I think it's an open and shut case at this point. And the sort of 9/11 of the Charlie Hebdo attack is that video of the policeman supposedly being shot on the sidewalk in front of the Charlie Hebdo offices. But he's not being shot. Everybody who's seen the video agrees. It's obvious that it's staged. And the guy, the terrorist who supposedly shoots him, actually purposely misses. He fires a blank round, not a real bullet. A real bullet would have cratered the sidewalk, and this blank round just kicks up a little dust. It's about a meter away from the guy's head. The head doesn't even react to being supposedly shot at point-blank range from an AK-47. So the Israeli-connected guy who posted that video online, apparently thinking that it was going to be a propaganda video, those horrible Muslim terrorists, really screwed up. And he should have looked at the video more closely before he posted it. And he has since been apologizing profusely. Apparently, he screwed up his role in their little covert operation. But anyway, just watch that video and then look it up, and you'll see that the French government still says that policeman is being shot in the head, point-blank range, with an AK-47. And he isn't. I mean, that's enough. You see that, you realize that there's a serious problem with this story.
Yeah, it's game over as far as their stage is concerned.
Absolutely. There are a couple of other really interesting items of information there, too, about, for instance, Éric Fredou was a brave police detective or investigator who was looking into these dicey connections around the Charlie Hebdo people connected with Zionist agents. And he was suicided in his office on the very night of the Charlie Hebdo attack. Found dead with a bullet in his head in his own office at 2 a.m., I think. They won't let his family see the autopsy results. I mean, you know, come on. I mean, when a guy investigating the case gets suicided like that, I mean, that's another dead giveaway, as it were.
It reminds me of the Mumbai police chief on the day of the Mumbai attack. He was suicided or got shot as well. They got rid of him to make sure that there was no investigation into it.
Yeah, apparently being an honest police officer can be dangerous if you have a big false flag happening in your backyard.
We have a question here from Carol in Manila in the Philippines. Is it possible that the Saudi nationals blamed for 9/11 were actually Israelis with Saudi passports?
Okay, that's an interesting question, Carol. I mean, yes and no. It looks like probably these Saudi passports did correspond to actual Saudi individuals, but there were also a number of cases of stolen identification being used by imposters posing as these alleged hijackers. There's a great article in the Zaremka book on 9/11. It's by a guy named Jay Kolar, and the title of the article is What We Now Know About the Alleged 9/11 Hijackers. And you can read this online at Google Books. And he goes into the evidence that several of these hijackers had people running duplicate IDs. For instance, Ziad Jarrah, who is from a family of heroin smuggling Mossad agents in Lebanon, they've arrested his other family members for working for the Mossad, and they're all allegedly tied in with dope trafficking. He was one of the alleged 9/11 hijackers, and there were three of them. There were three guys, you know, on ID cards, totally different, three different people using Ziad Jarrah IDs running around setting up a trail to make him look like a 9/11 hijacker. And likewise, Mohammed Atta, the original, was Egyptian. He didn't speak Hebrew. But the guy in Florida posing as Mohammed Atta spoke fluent Hebrew, and his favorite food was pork chops. He was a devotee of prostitutes, cocaine, and gambling, which is very strange for an Islamic fundamentalist. So there are a lot of these cases where we had apparently there were like actual, you know, patsies whose ID was then used by other people to set them up.
Right, right. We have a question here from Cheryl in Pennsylvania. What percentage of your colleagues at the University of Wisconsin know about 9/11 Truth? And did any of them reach out to you in support?
That's a good question. Before I was witch hunted out of the university in 2006, I discussed it with several of my colleagues. And essentially, all of them had about the same reaction, which was, you know, I don't really want to look into this because I'm afraid it might be true. That's a direct quote from one of them. But it essentially represents the attitudes of several others as well. I didn't meet a single colleague in those years who disagreed with me. But then after I was witch hunted, they dug up a couple of apparently, you know, Bush-supporting professors at the university to badmouth me. There's a law professor named Ann Althaus. There's a physics professor named Marshall O'Nellian. And then there's a political science professor named Donald, what's his name? Forgetting Donald's last name. And anyway, these three people really insulted me in the media, you know, said I should be fired and things like that. And then I actually did meet one colleague who was the head of the religious studies program who disagreed with me. You know, so the whole time I was there, the vast majority of colleagues I talked to didn't think it was particularly unlikely that I was right. There were three who showed up in the media insulting me after I was witch hunted. And then I finally did meet one who actually said he disagreed with me. So that was the reaction. But none of them rallied strongly to my defense. The best among them was a guy named Jim Leary, head of the folklore program. He's a really good guy. He didn't want to go out and blow up his career by saying, yeah, Barrett's right. But he did. He sponsored an event. He let the folklore program sponsor an event called 9/11 Fact and Folklore. And the BBC came and covered it. So a shout out to Jim Leary, who also, he was actually just considered for a Grammy Award for his work on Wisconsin folk music this past year. And he's a really good guy. Of all of my colleagues, like, he was the only one that really showed any guts at all.
Right, right. My question to you, so who in your mind were the real masterminds of 9/11? Was it PNAC? Was it the ADL? Was it Mossad? Was it Larry Silverstein, Dick Cheney, or a combination of all the above crooks?
Well, probably the answer would be D, combination of the above. Precisely how that combination worked, I think, you know, requires a little bit of a interrogation of the suspects, but we could pretty easily figure it out. I mean, anybody who had the authority to arrest all of those people you mentioned and a whole lot more and promise them leniency in exchange for truthful testimony could solve this case in a heartbeat. And so Why won't they? Well, who's going to bell the cat? I mean, who's got the power to interrogate these people?
Yeah, absolutely. How important is it, do you believe, for critical thinking for the people to engage in?
Well, that's what my university career was supposedly dedicated to, I thought. I mean, that's why I got involved with the academy. I mean, I saw the university community as people who supposedly were sort of protected from political winds by tenure and things like that, who had the mission of being public intellectuals who were supposed to go out and, you know, fight the good fight and, you know, speak truth to power and, you know, rip off the veil and, you know, all that stuff. I mean, I grew up in the Woodward and Bernstein era with journalism and then saw kind of some of the same ideals transferred to the academy. So that's how I thought it was supposed to work. And, you know, unfortunately, of course, it doesn't. that's life.
Mm. Can you tell the audience here what's one of your most memorable experiences over the years that you, in your work that you've done so far?
Let's see, memorable experiences in 9/11. Well, there've been a whole lot. I guess getting dragged onto Hannity and Combs that first time was pretty unforgettable. I'd never been on TV before. I didn't even know who Hannity and Combs were, really. I'd been spending, you know, I spent most of the decade buried in my Arabic textbooks, you know, studying medieval Morocco. So I wasn't really paying attention to anything that was going on in the world, much less TV, much less Fox. So having them just call me out of the blue and say, yeah, we want you on Fox News, you know, we're going to come pick you up with a limo, take you to Milwaukee, blah, blah, blah. And so they did, and found myself up on a big platform in the middle of this Fox room, surrounded by people in desks and cubicles around me. And I couldn't see Hannity or Combs. I just had to talk. I could hear them. That was a kind of memorable experience. And my first reaction was I thought maybe I'd been a little too strident and nervous because I'd, you know, had a strong cup of coffee beforehand. But then afterwards, my phone started ringing off the hook and people were saying, you know, like, Faiz Khan, an MD friend of mine, you know, called immediately, said, wow, I was in the airport and I just happened to see you on Fox. And you shredded Hannity. That was great. And so that was all pretty cool.
Excellent. We have a question from Tom in Nebraska. Were you surprised that the Catholic Church movie Spotlight won the Best Picture? And do you think something like that could be possible with a 9/11 related film?
You know, the problem here is that Spotlight is going with the grain of the people who run the media. The pedophilia in the Catholic Church is not a no-go zone anymore. I mean, it may have been in the past. You know, locally, the church maybe had enough power to crush various investigations. But in terms of the big media, they don't care about that anymore. They're perfectly happy to pillory the pedophile priest, which is why you've heard about all the pedophile priests. But you may not have heard about the pedophile rabbis in the bathhouses of New York and Jerusalem and other cities. Rabbis repeatedly rape children as a matter of course. It's just a normal thing in their bathhouses. There's an article by Christopher Ketchum on this, and it's just horrifying. But who's heard about that? Well, there's a reason why you've heard about the pedophile priests and you haven't heard about the pedophile rabbis, and that is who controls your media. People who control your media don't want you to hear about the pedophile rabbis, and they're very happy to have you hear about the pedophile priests. Now, right. Those same people who control the media don't want you to hear about who really did 9/11 for pretty obvious reasons.
So it's part of the agenda at the moment to spread that.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think there's been a kind of a pushback against Catholicism coming from a lot of different directions. It's not entirely a bad thing. But it's been going on for centuries, you know. Under one interpretation that I'm currently translating a book on this by a French historian, and he argues that even the Protestant Reformation was largely the creation of the wealthy and powerful segment of the organized Jewish community. Whoa. And so there's been a pushback against organized Christianity in general and the Catholic Church in particular from this very, very, you know, top level of the organized Jewish community. And of course, that doesn't implicate the vast majority of Jewish people, but, you know, I'm just trying to explain how it is. And so those folks are perfectly happy to dangle out the dirty laundry of the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm. Do you see much hope on the horizon as far as people waking up to what a scam is going on in the world?
Yeah, I do. I think people are waking up. The last three articles I've published on the recent false flags, on the Paris attacks, San Bernardino attacks, and the Brussels attacks, they all immediately jump to about 100,000 to all the way up to close to 500,000 views very quickly. So that's a lot of people who are looking for information about these events being false flags. And I think we also see a parallel increase in people interested in all of these other issues of bankster control of people through the issuance of usury currency, the geoengineering and chemtrails issue that, you know, Prince talked about, the political assassinations, election fraud, all of these kinds of issues that never get any play in the mainstream except ridicule. More and more people are waking up and saying, hey, you know, I think maybe there's a reason why these things are being ridiculed in the mainstream. It's because these are really the dangerous, important issues. And so thanks to the internet, more and more people are becoming aware of these things.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. One final question, sir. Very quick one. Do you support the stop funding of Israel?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm not a fanatic about this. I would be happy to see all of the Jews who are there stay there and live peacefully with their neighbors as equals. That's what and if the ones who don't want to be equal should leave, they should go somewhere else. And we can make that happen. The United States has the power to make that happen. We should stop funding Israel and we should start supporting the Palestinians. If we did that, there would be peace within, you know, a heartbeat.
Absolutely. You've been listening to The People Who Speak radio show with special guest and author, Dr. Kevin Barrett. I'd like to thank him and remind all the listeners to visit his website at www.truthjihad.com. Thanks so much for being on the show today, Dr. Barrett, sir.
Okay. Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it.
God bless. Stay tuned very soon for special guests Carlos Latouf and Mike Rivero coming soon on The People Speak show. Big thanks go out to the producers, Mike, Doug, and Donald, to all my friends throughout the world, and to all the guys who give me so much support. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. You can tune into my own channel on YouTube called Stop Funding Israel. But for me for now, take care and bye until next time.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.